Hey. So, two episodes this week. I know, right? Crazy. It's crazy. So, if you haven't listened to the previous episode, please go back and listen to it. It was a very fun chat about two movies, Call Me By Your Name and Love, Simon. So, go back and listen to that if you haven't yet listened to it. But this episode is about American Crime Story, the assassination of Gianni Versace. This is a show that absolutely riveted me throughout the season. It just finished. The finale was last night as I taped this on Thursday night. But you can, if you haven't watched it yet, you can watch it on demand, FX on demand. Hopefully this episode can turn you on to wanting to watch it. If you already have watched it, hopefully you enjoy the conversation that I have with Paste Magazine TV editor Matt Brennan. He's written a couple of great pieces about this show. So without further ado, let's go to that conversation. All right, on the phone with me now is Matt Brennan. Matt is the TV editor at Paste Magazine. Matt, thanks so much for joining me on the show today. So, Matt, you've written beautifully about American Crime Story, the assassination of Gianni Versace. It's such a long title to spit out that I wanted to have you on the show to talk about this show that, as I said in the intro before I put you on, this show has just absolutely riveted me from start to finish. I know you've sort of felt the same way. Give the audience just kind of a brief synopsis, because I know you'll give a better one than I could do, just of what this show is all about.
Yeah, so first of all, it's the second season of an anthology series created by Ryan Murphy of Glee and American Horror Story and Feud and many other shows of fame. The first season followed the trial of O.J. Simpson. It starred Sarah Paulson and Sterling K. Brown, among others, and it really sort of blew up and became kind of a cultural phenomenon and touchstone. The second season begins with the murder of fashion designer Gianni Versace on the steps of his South Beach home in 1997, but its main focus is his killer, a man named Andrew Cunanan, and it works in reverse chronological order and traces Cunanan back through a series of murders that he committed in the months leading up to Versace's murder, all the way back to his childhood in California, while occasionally toggling back to Versace's rise, his relationship with his partner of 15 years, Antonio D'Amico, and his often sort of tumultuous or testy relationship with his sister Donatella, who took over the Versace business after his death.
So let's talk about the reverse chronological order of the episodes, because I think it's something that obviously jumps out to you right away, because they literally start the season with the assassination. I mean, that's the very first scene. It's a beautiful scene. There's almost no dialogue in that sequence. There's beautiful music playing, and you see the assassination, and that's what that's the title of the show. And then it works backwards. Did you like the reverse chronological order, the way that Ryan Murphy chose to play this out?
I did. I think the merit of it is not that it's a compelling gimmick, although you do have a moment, especially. And so each episode unspools in order, but then the subsequent episode will begin earlier and kind of end where the prior episode began,
right,
or somewhere thereabouts. And so there's a compelling element, certainly in the initial stages of trying to get your bearings, but for me, the real value of it was the way that it sort of shifted the focus away from the spectacle that surrounded Versace's death and the 8-day manhunt for Cunanan that followed. I was aware of the fact that Cunanan had murdered several other men before he killed Versace, but I don't think that's like a sort of commonly known thing, or if it is, people don't know, and I include myself in this, much about the other victims.
Right.
Three of whom were gay men. One was a real estate developer named Lee Miglin in Chicago. One was an architect named David Madsen, and one was a former naval officer named Jeff Trail. The fifth victim was a man named William Reese, who was a cemetery caretaker in in New Jersey, who Cunanan killed and stole his car. But I think that, so to me, the value of the reverse chronological order is that it really refocuses the arc of the story not on the killing of Versace and its aftermath, but on sort of the creation of a monster in the form of Andrew Cunanan, and not just the deaths, but also the lives of his other victims, who up until this point have, in pop cultural terms, remained largely anonymous.
Right, so the going reverse, like you said, it shines the light on the other victims, and like you said, creating the monster. And part of one of the things that the show really also shines a light on is the fact that these other victims weren't huge celebrities like Gianni Versace. They were just, you know, three gay guys, and because they didn't have a high profile, and because of the homophobia at that time. I mean, Andrew Cunanan was basically able to just get away with murdering these men with no repercussions until he took out the celebrity.
I really think the thing that struck me most forcefully from the beginning, even more than the structure, was just to be clear for your listeners, critics received 8 of the 9 episodes relatively far in advance of the premiere.
Uh-huh.
And so I watched all 8 of them in a row.
Yep.
And took notes for my initial column, which ran around the time of the premiere back in January. And watching them all in a row, you kind of, the reverse chronological order thing, quickly I just sort of got used to it, and it was interesting. But once you have figured that out,
yeah,
there are a couple moments where the timeline gets a little bit unclear. But for the most part, it's unorthodox for TV, but it's not unheard of if you've seen a movie like Memento or Irreversible or something. What struck me most was that from the very beginning, from the premiere, and then throughout several subsequent episodes, the series, which is written by a man named Tom Rob Smith, who wrote a great miniseries on the BBC, and I think it's streaming possibly on Netflix, don't quote me on that, called London Spy, Ben Whishaw, that is also sort of about these themes. I loved that about a couple years ago. The way that he scripts it and the way that it's sort of conceived, the show focuses very intently on how the police and the FBI investigators were negligent, in part because of their homophobia.
Right.
Some of that is expressed sort of like open disdain for queer people.
Yeah.
And even including Versace, even after he's been killed. It also, though, extends to sort of not understanding certain, I don't know what the word would be, conventions of gay romantic and sexual relationships.
Right.
And in that ignorance, ignoring, possible outcomes. So one example is when after Jeff Trail is murdered and they find his body in David Manson's apartment,
yep.
They also find a number of sex toys and a harness and some leather gear, and immediately jump to the conclusion that, and I believe that I'm quoting directly when I say that one of the cops says David was into, quote, some extreme stuff.
Yep, I remember that, yep.
The sorts of dismissive comments that the police make throughout end up culminating in the finale with a speech given by a junkie who Conan encounters in Miami before he kills Versace, named Ronnie, played by Max Greenfield from New Girl, who's great in the role, by the way.
Yeah, amazing.
He is being interrogated by the police. He says pretty explicitly, and to me, summing up really the whole thrust of the series, "You didn't care about us because we were gay and because we weren't famous and because you had all these assumptions about us. So you didn't even really try to catch him.
Right.
You only put muscle into this when someone famous got killed."
Right.
And I think that that is, that to me, the sort of question of how and when and to whom and where and why gay people become visible, you know, seen or heard, is the central theme or motif of the whole 9 episodes. And to weave it in throughout the way that they did is the thing that struck me the most and to me was maybe the most impressive about it. I liked all aspects of the show, but that was the thing that really, when I first watched it, I was like, oh, they're really on to something with this.
Yeah, that interrogation and that, I guess you just call it a speech, by the character Ronnie was really one of the biggest moments in the entire series. It's in the finale, but it's really kind of almost the thesis of the entire series. And Ronnie, who up to that point had only been in, what, one other episode? He was only in episode 2? He gets maybe arguably the biggest moment of the series.
It's interesting. I didn't really get a chance to explore it so I did 2 pieces, one at the very beginning of the series and then one that ran today at the very end. And so I didn't get to discuss it at length, but one of the things that kind of struck me about Ryan Murphy and Tom Ralph Smith giving Ronnie this sort of key climactic monologue.
Yep.
And not Versace or Donatella or Antonio or Conanin or anyone else, is that he is the embodiment of the anonymous queer person.
Yeah.
He also is HIV positive, and a drug addict, and he's known for being a little bit of a, I guess, like a skis bag around South Beach. Like, he's known to the cops. Mm-hmm. He's exactly the kind of person that gets ignored by authorities, even when they're killed. And I think, to me, he gets to be the voice of the relatively anonymous victims of Conan up to that point, who are no longer alive to sort of save themselves. He operates as their stand-in.
Right.
And that, to me, is sort of like Murphy and Smith giving the victims a microphone, a megaphone that Conan and then the media took away from them.
Right. Yeah, and again, that was Max Greenfield who plays that character, and he gets a huge moment that we just talked about in the finale. I want to also talk about episode 3, A Random Killing. I was really blown away by Judith Light's performance in that episode. A lot of the listeners probably know her from Transparent, but what she does in this episode really just blew me away. Explain to the listeners what her character or who her character is, and your thoughts on her performance.
Light plays Marilyn Miglin, who is the wife of Lee Miglin, who was the third of Conan's victims. Lee Miglin was, and this is, my knowledge of him is and not on the book that it's based on, which is called Vulgar Favors, and is written by a Vanity Fair correspondent, Maury Horse. So I am not 100% sure exactly what got fudged or fictionalized and what didn't. But in the show, Miglin is a very successful real estate developer in Chicago who's also a closeted gay man and has had a previous relationship with Kunanen, who occasionally worked as an escort or a sort of kept boy or sexual companion to older men in particular. Light plays Lee's wife, Marilyn, who sells cosmetics on like a home shopping network kind of thing. And A Random Killing is the first episode where you really get a departure from the sort of Versace storyline.
Right.
Like, the premiere begins with his killing. The second episode focuses on Kunanen arriving in Miami, so it's sort of about the build-up to that killing.
Yep.
You know, he's scoping out Versace's house. The third episode opens with Judith Light's character, Marilyn Miglin, dressed in like a pink blazer, getting out of a cab with her luggage and going into her house in Chicago. And Yep. You're like, how is this related?
Right, exactly.
If you're not aware of the fact that there were prior murders.
Right.
So it's just this great way, to me, it was this great way, and I think it's, if I had to pick one, it's the best episode of the series. It's this great way of sort of immersing you in this other person's world and very quickly, like, sketching these characters. And Judith Light, as a woman who, I mean, first of all, she senses that something is wrong when she arrives home, and that, without giving it away, the whole sequence that follows from that is unbelievably good. And just, oh, man.
Yeah.
And the way that she uses her face, there at two particular moments in episode one, in that sort of suspenseful early scene, and then one toward the end when she's taking off her makeup in the mirror.
Right.
Is really extraordinary. I fully expect her to win a guest Emmy for this role.
Yeah.
I am hard pressed to imagine someone giving a better guest performance in a limited series.
And I think I wrote this down because I rewatched that episode as the end of the first part of the episode, after she's come home and she figures out kind of what happened, she literally says, "I knew it."
Yeah, and the way the camera is looking at her, so you see her face very clearly.
Yeah.
And her face is completely impassive, and she says, "I knew it."
And what she's saying is, I knew that my husband was gay, is what she's saying.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Do you think that's what she was saying?
I think the whole point is that she's saying two things. She's saying, one, I knew something was wrong.
Yeah.
Two, I knew that he was gay, or I knew that his being gay and sneaking around would get him in trouble or put him in danger. I don't think it's like 100% clear exactly what she means, because she could theoretically mean several different things by it.
Yeah.
I do think that the show is pretty clear that she is both aware that her husband is gay and in the closet, and two, unwilling to discuss that probability.
Right.
For example, with the police. So
right.
The investigators come to her house and are asking her questions to try to figure out what she might know about Kunanen, and she essentially dismisses out of hand the idea that it's not just a random killing,
yeah.
A burglary, even though there's nothing really other than cash and the car has been stolen. It really crystallizes for me what subsequent episodes that are focused on David Madison and Jeff Trail do, which is they become these really brilliant, queer, compelling, suspenseful bottle episodes that home in on one of Kunanen's victims and very quickly give them their turn in the spotlight.
Yep.
And I just thought it was like a really daring way of structuring a story that, frankly, I think is pretty difficult to tell. And it's especially difficult to tell while you're going backwards in time.
Right.
Those three episodes were the ones that convinced me that it was a great show. A Random Killing, House by the Lake, and Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
Yeah.
Third, fourth, and fifth of the series.
Right.
Were the ones where I was like, this isn't just a solid rendition of a true crime drama. This is going for something more ambitious and more risky than that.
Yeah. So Cody Fearn is the name of the actor that plays David Madsen, and then Finn Wittrock plays Jeff Trail, and you get to see Finn in his full Navy uniform, which is a beautiful sight to see. What did you think of these two guys' performances? I thought episode four, House by the Lake, it's incredibly creepy. And the shower scene is like something out of Psycho or something. Did you actually write that, or did I read that from somebody else?
I wrote that. I don't know. You might have, someone else might have said it, but that was in my piece.
Yeah. I mean, it just, it was so chilly, so creepy.
So one of the things that I really, that I thought was kind of fascinating and also telling is that what was really happening to me, especially in these middle episodes, is Murphy and I believe House by the Lake is directed by Dan Minahan, who co-wrote I Shot Andy Warhol and did some other sort of projects that have a kind of relationship to the new queer cinema of the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And he's been a director on television for a long time. If A Random Killing is an episode that kind of feels like a sort of domestic melodrama with a twist, so it's referring to something that has kind of queer associations, from its color palette and Marilyn's obsession with appearances, to the kind of like secret lives that people are leading. The fourth episode really feels like a horror movie. It's incredibly, the murder of Jeff Trail happens in the opening minutes, and it is exceedingly gruesome.
Right.
Hard to watch. And then from there, essentially what happens is Kunanen kidnaps or holds David Madsen captive under duress in order to keep him from going to the police. And David, in order to survive, kind of plays along.
Right.
And so there's the first half of the episode is very much to me like a kind of queer spin on a horror movie.
Yeah.
A queer Psycho, really.
Yeah.
Psycho's already a little queer, but a more queer Psycho.
Yeah.
And then the second half is kind of like a queer road movie with horror elements. And really, that to me is doing a lot to kind of say, okay, we're going to work in a lot of genres that seem familiar to you, but if you're paying close attention, there's something else going on here. And one of the things that I wrote about that I was disappointed by is that a lot of critics didn't write about that.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure if they didn't pick up on it or if they dismissed it or what. But I was disappointed that a lot of critics sort of said that they didn't like this season as much as the OJ season, but didn't really try to analyze it on its own terms. And I thought both Fearn and Wittrock they just do this amazing job of like, they immediately make you, I mean, it's agonizing to watch because you know, I mean, by the time you get to know them, they've already been killed.
Right.
And then you get to know them and it doubly makes you agonize over the fact that, like, these really good guys who, in a much sort of different era for gay rights, were really doing the best they can or could. And they were starting to, both of them were starting to make strides. Manson comes out to his father. We see Jeff Trail leave the military in the era of Don't Ask, Don't Tell and actually go and give an anonymous interview to 60 Minutes about it,
right.
Which happened in real life. These were, and the actors really convey just how decent these guys were. And frankly, it was their decency. It was their sort of feelings of wanting to do right by Andrew, who they had met socially and originally had liked but become kind of uncomfortable with.
Right.
That actually ended up putting them in danger.
Yeah.
I think that it's, that is really where you, where you really see him. I mean, he's obviously a monster the moment he pulls the gun on Versace, but at that point he seems like this sort of crazed lunatic.
Right.
The way that he preys on Miglin, Madsen, and Trail, it is where I started to be like, oh no, this is just a monster.
So let's shift gears a second. We'll get to Darren Criss's amazing performance in the lead role in a second, but I want to go to Penelope Cruz as Donatella Versace. I just love this performance. It's sort of campy, but the moment you first see her getting off that plane in the first episode, I was just like, I was totally sold on Penelope Cruz in this role. The episode, to me, I think that she really stands out because she's not given a ton to do. It's a supporting role. It was probably episode 7, the episode with the dress, with basically it's her version of the Adam Rippon dress at the Oscars. It's her harness. It's her black leather harness dress. So I loved her in this role. What did you think?
I liked her too, and I think it's in part because I read, especially because the sort of Versace aspect gets diminished more and more as the series goes on. I mean, there are whole, I don't know if there are whole episodes, but there are long stretches where no one in the sort of Versace universe is on screen.
Right.
And I read it as kind of this, you putting this sort of fantasy world of possibility that Andrew is kind of dreaming of, because he's like a major social climber.
Yeah.
And it's kind of showing you an aspect of what he's sort of dreaming towards or what he thinks he deserves, even though he never actually picks up a finger to try to get it. And in that sort of fantasy aspect, I think the show finds enough of the levity to not be, like, completely bogged down by just how dark the canon stuff is.
Yep.
So, like, to me, every time, even though it's not, like, jokey, and it's a little campy, but it's not, like, over the top.
Yeah.
Every time Gianni and Donatella and Antonio are, like, bickering on screen, it's felt kind of like a relief. Like, okay, whew, I get, like, a scene off from the really hard stuff.
Right.
To kind of watch these people who really did take Gianni's talent and turn it through their own, you know, intuition and wit and abilities into this multi-million dollar fashion empire. I love the scene where he sort of puts her in the dress and she kind of becomes his muse, but also his collaborator,
mm-hmm.
because it really does remind you of, like, even though they fought tooth and nail about all kinds of things in terms of the family business, they, like, really deeply loved and respected and admired each other.
Right.
And that's why they were successful as a pair. It's because they pushed each other in the right ways, but they supported each other when it pushed came to shove.
Right. So then Edgar Ramirez, he plays Gianni Versace. And again, he's not in it a ton. It's not really a lead role, even though his name is in the title. What did you think he brought to the role? I thought he brought the charisma and just sort of the magic that you would need to bring to that kind of a persona. But what did you think?
I mean, he's probably of any of the actors, he is the one who physically transformed into his character most closely. Like, I mean, he's a version of Gianni Versace in the 90s, especially the later 90s, is like really close to the actual Versace.
Right.
I have to say that, like, I think it's a solid performance, and I think he does a lot with a role that is not as showy as, you know, Penelope Cruz with Lateef, or Darren Criss with, like, playing this sort of psychopathic killer.
Yep.
Or Judith Light getting to play this sort of, you know, unhappy wife. Or Max Greenfield getting to play, like, a kind of, you know, Razzo Rizzo type. You really, I think, maybe need that for kind of just, like, to get a baseline on, like, you know, okay, here is, like, just a kind of a normal human being who happens to have struck it rich because he's highly talented. But I don't know. I mean, although I was disappointed that Craigs didn't pick up on some of the key themes and concepts that I think the series raises, I myself don't think that it's flawless, and I am sort of open to criticism, and I think people who pointed to the fact that there's a kind of imbalance between how compelling the canon stuff is and how, by comparison, sort of flat the Versace stuff is, have a point. I think in trying to set up the contrast that they're setting up between Cunanan and Versace, they maybe went a little too far in making Versace kind of godlike. There's not a sense that he was sort of like a flawed figure. Certainly not to the extent that, like, Donatello really comes across, even in brief stretches, is like this really fascinatingly eccentric person. Versace himself, I think, maybe doesn't have as much texture.
And I want
Ramirez is very solid in the role.
Yeah, I wonder if some of the issues that some of the critics have with it is the fact that the title, you know, Versace is in the title. If the title had been Andrew Cunanan, you know, something Madness or whatever, you know, the search for or whatever they want to make, if his name was in the title, then it would be more right out there in the open. This story is more about him than it is about Versace.
I have to admit, and I did this in print, so I don't have any qualms about doing it here. I have to call bullshit on the people who are saying that the title is misleading.
Right.
The title is not The Life and Death of Gianni Versace. The title is The Assassination of Gianni Versace. I don't think that the series fails to deliver on that. It really is like a 9-episode deep dive into... So, like, one of the connotations of an assassination is that it's a targeted killing meant for a political or religious purpose, but one of its sort of sub-definitions is that it's a killing meant to gain someone notoriety or fame. And the whole series is built around sort of exploring Cunanan's desperate desire to be famous or well-known, or the word that's often used in the series is special,
right,
and how a combination of factors could drive him to try to do that through murdering someone famous. And so I actually think that what Murphy is doing is something that he did with Feud, which is he's kind of tricking the viewer into making the same mistakes that we're going to criticize and eventually going to criticize in the characters. So I wrote about this when Feud came out, because Feud does this thing, and I absolutely was guilty of it. I watched the first couple episodes of Feud and was like, this isn't bitchy enough. This is fun. I want, like, cat fights.
Yeah.
And then I was like, oh, the whole point of Feud is that what ruins these women's careers as they get older is that we are itching for a fight.
Yeah.
Not giving them a shot to, like, sort of age gracefully as actors.
Yeah.
And in the same way, I think critics who were, like, yearning for the spectacle of the Versace murder are participating in exactly the thing that Murphy is critiquing about how the story of Andrew Cunanan was told at the time, which is that all the focus is on the Versace murder and not on the other victims. And that, to me, is just, like, he's doing this really ingenious thing where he's making you, the viewer, fall into the very trap that he's going to say, aha, see? It's like, hard not to fall into that trap. Like, that's the thing is, I don't think he's trying to make you feel bad.
Right.
I do think he's trying to put you in a position where you really are forced to think through some of the unexamined assumptions that we all bring to stories about women, stories about gay men, stories about fashion, stories about sex, stories that don't fit the mold of what we usually take seriously in pop culture.
Yeah, and a quick side note, Feud I also loved, so if the listeners have not watched that show, I would recommend watching Feud. The episode, the Oscars episode of that miniseries, that I think was my favorite episode of that run, was the Oscars one.
Yeah, that one actually made my personal list, and I think Pace's list, if I remember correctly, of the best episodes of the year.
Oh, there you go.
There's a long shot that follows through, like, in between one award being given out and the next award being given out. The camera follows David Lean and Joan Crawford through the entire bowels of the theater.
Right.
And then kind of comes out on the other side, and it's just like, wow.
Yeah.
It's one of those moments where you're just like, oh, damn, okay, great. This is excellent.
Yeah, that was such a good show. What did you think of Ricky Martin in his role as Versace's longtime partner? I always found myself as I was watching him, I always knew, okay, I'm watching Ricky Martin. I thought he was fine, but what did you think?
He's not a natural.
Yeah.
Let's put it that way. So Ricky Martin, total babe. I think he definitely.
He looked good in his tennis whites.
Yeah, well, until they got covered in his partner's.
That's true.
Which is actually, like, one of the. I will say this. He gets a little bit lost in the role when he has to kind of hold his own with trained actors like Cruz and Ramirez.
Yeah.
During kind of like the bickering scenes earlier on, where he's trying to. So Antonio's struggle in the show is. He's very supportive of Gianni, and Donatella is always skeptical of him, and also skeptical of Gianni living openly as a gay man, and all kinds of different stuff. But Antonio, in the end, isn't a member of the family,
yeah.
And so he's, like, always kind of in this awkward position. In those scenes, I think Martin's lack of training and experience as an actor kind of shows through, and he kind of just recedes into the background. But there is a moment in the premiere when he's being interviewed by the police in his tennis whites, which are stained with blood
right.
after the murder, and he's the only sort of person on screen, and the officer is talking about their sex lives, and the officer basically says in a kind of like sneering or leering sort of way, like, I heard that you all had other men that you slept with either alone or together.
Right.
And Antonio is sort of a little bit like, yeah, I don't see what this really has to do with this. And the guy says, would you consider those men Gianni's partners?
Yep.
And the way Ricky Martin delivers in the next line, or when the other guy is like, so what makes the difference between you and those, you know, One Night Stand, the way Ricky Martin delivers the line 15 years, mm-hmm. 15 years together yeah. is the difference.
Right.
Suggests to me that, like, he has the potential to be a strong actor. He just needs to have more roles.
Yeah. Yeah, that the delivering of that 15 years line was, like, that was his Ronnie moment, kind of, but it came in the opening of the series instead of the finale.
And it really does a nice job of bookending that scene because you know, as much as obviously Antonio was adjacent to a famous man and is better known than Ronnie, who I'm not even sure if Ronnie is based on an actual real person.
Right.
But comparatively speaking, Antonio is pretty anonymous. So, like, you have a relatively unknown gay man introduce this theme of gay men being made invisible or forgotten or mistreated or undervalued or demeaned by the police, who are kind of the representative of society as a whole in the show. And then you get that wrapped up at the end in the finale, and it really is just the overarching sort of motif. So he does what he needs to do in that scene.
Yep. So let's get to Darren Criss. I mean, I would think he probably should make some room on his mantle for an Emmy for this performance. I mean, he plays the madness, he plays the self-hatred, he plays the charisma that this character did have. And he, you know, he does a good job of really just carrying the show.
I mean, so I'll put it this way. Every year, at the end of the year, like many publications, Pace does a list of the best TV shows, the best TV episodes, and the best TV performances, among other year-end lists. And because there's so much TV these days, I keep a kind of running long list of things that I think of. Like, the moment I see them and determine they, I should think of them later when I'm making the final list,
right.
I add them. So far, the only male actor in a drama who is on my list is Darren Criss. There have been a lot of really strong female performances, mostly in comedies so far this year. Darren Criss, just like when I think about, like, okay, based on what the limited series actor category is going to look like when the nominations, what's going to be eligible when the nominations come around in late spring, early summer. Yeah, I can't really think of anything that is even in the same ballpark as what he's doing in this role. I mean, you can quibble with whether the character has enough depth to carry 9 episodes. I think you can maybe even say that, like, his performance only hits, like, a couple of notes because of that. But those notes that he hits are... I found that his performance completely mesmerizing and utterly frightening.
Exactly. And it's a different performance, really, from anything he's done, right? I don't completely know his IMDb page, but it's definitely not similar to most things he's done, right?
I'm in front of my computer, so I'm going to...
It's obviously different than Glee.
He is best known for playing Blaine on Glee, who has a few, like, sort of nice moments. I actually think that the a cappella rendition that the all-boys boarding school does of Teenage Dream is better than Katy Perry's original. that's my Glee thought for the day.
There you go.
This is so far beyond anything that he's ever done that I've seen that I think it maybe opens him up to, like, an entirely new echelon of possibilities, you know, for his career.
Right.
Like, I think this is a career changer for him.
Yeah.
I hope that it is, because it really shows a level of commitment that is impressive and pays off, because he has this kind of impossible task where he has to be the sort of thing that carries the series, that holds all of these disparate elements and far-flung characters together. And he also has to be a monster who we don't... The show does try to understand how he became this way, but it doesn't ever, for me, go into the realm of being sympathetic to him or pitying him. And to try to balance that, to try to hold our attention while also holding this character in this, like, really dark place all the time,
right,
has to be really tough to do.
Right. Now, what did you think about the episode which deals with his childhood and the performances by the actors that play his mother and father? That episode I had to revisit because I was kind of transfixed, especially by the performance of the father. So the father is played by John. I don't know if I'm pronouncing this right. John Briones.
I'm not sure if that's how his last name is pronounced.
Yeah.
Either. I'm sorry, I should know that, but yes. I thought that, I mean, as sort of like villain origin stories go, I found, I'm not sure how, I don't really know enough about the sort of clinical kind of understanding of sociopathy or psychopathy to comment on whether it's a sort of realistic depiction of how, say, a child who grows up with, like, a really damaged, borderline deranged parent.
Right.
How that would sort of affect a child. I did find the way in which Briones and Chris, it's like Briones watched what Chris was doing in the episode where he plays the adult Kunanin.
Yep.
And was able to kind of like channel some of the in terms of like character traits, the kind of family resemblance you see between them is striking.
Right.
And the way in which Andrew's relationship with his father shapes both his expectation of being famous and wealthy and well-respected and special, and his unwillingness to actually do the real work required to earn all those designations strikes me as being very true to the ways in which we are all both imitating and trying to escape our parents at the same time.
Yeah.
And how the older I get, the more I realize I'm like my parents. In my case, for better more than for worse, but there's still some things where I'm like, oh, yeah, that thing that really bothered me when I was growing up about my dad, I definitely do that.
Right. We can all say, we can all say that kind of stuff. And I say that kind of stuff. And I thought that episode is the second to last episode, and it really ties everything together nicely as far as understanding where the monster that is Andrew kind of came from. And then they jump ahead for the finale, and it kind of ties things up beautifully, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the series does a pretty brilliant job of finding... The way that I wrote about it is it does a really great job of trying to suss out the sort of differences between this icon and his assassin. But it is also, and it understands just how damaging being in the closet is, whether you end up being a major success or a major failure. But what it does by bringing in all these other elements, whether it's Kunanin's childhood and his relationship with his father, whether it's his father's sort of abusive relationship with Andrew's mother, whether it's his experience in high school, whether it's his feeling of who murdered him, are all the other things that determine what the life of an adult gay man looks like. And so it does this great balancing act where it acknowledges that homophobia in our culture and the sort of need to be in the closet when you're growing up as a gay adolescent is tremendously psychologically damaging, and that's still true. That's not less true, I don't think, in 2018. Or it's not untrue in 2018, even if it might be less damaging than it was in, say, 1998. But it also is very careful not to pathologize that or to give Kunan in a pass and say, well, he lived in a homophobic society, so he became a murderer. Like, that obviously doesn't make any real sense.
Right.
You wouldn't want a show to go too far in that direction. But the balance that it strikes between understanding the dangers that homophobia sort of poses to queer people and the fact that there are a million other factors that end up creating what someone's life looks like, I thought it was really brilliant. And to me, the finale is kind of, in some ways, I have to say that the finale is more like a, I don't want to call it an anticlimax because that's a negative term, but it's like punctuation on what was already, I was already sold.
Yeah.
And I think the finale kind of underlines some of the key themes, maybe to the point of being overly blunt about it. But like, I didn't need the finale to think that this was a great show.
So talk a little bit and tell the audience where they can find those two columns, two great columns that you wrote about this show. Don't give everything away that's in the columns because we want the listeners to actually read them. But just kind of point the audience in the direction where to find them and then what these two columns are about.
So my initial column is called Faggots, or How I Learned to Stop Wearing and Love Versace. And it is specifically about the use of the word faggot in American Crime Story, the assassination of Gianni Versace, because I think it appears, or it's heard more, it's spoken more in many different ways in context in the 9 episodes of the series than I think in all the other television I've seen in my career as a TV critic combined.
Yeah.
And I deal with that and my own kind of relationship with the term as a gay man. And then my second piece is called Why the Assassination of Gianni Versace is the Year's Most Underappreciated TV Show. And in that, I look at both the show and the reviews of the show and try to talk about why I think it didn't break out in the way that the O.J. Simpson season did, and why I think that has less to do with the quality of the show than with some of the kind of unacknowledged biases and cultural scripts that critics follow. And you can find both of those at pacemagazine.com.
And what's your...
Click on TV.
Give your Twitter, too. Give your Twitter, too, so they can find you on Twitter.
Yes, my Twitter is at the Film Goer.
Perfect. So also, Matt, before I let you go, I think I've kept you here longer than we thought, but it's been a great conversation. Are there any shows that the people out there that should be looking at now that Versace is done?
I'm going to shill for a show. I'll shill for two. One actually needs people to watch it. It's a show called One Day at a Time. It's a remake of the classic Norman Lear sitcom, updated with a Cuban-American family in Los Angeles, and it stars Rita Moreno and Justina Machado, who are both excellent in it. Both of the co-creators have tweeted in recent weeks about how Netflix is still evaluating whether to renew it for a third season. I would love for everyone to watch it so that it could get renewed for a third season because I think it's terrific. And the other one, and I have to say, I'm not sure that if you don't already have it, I would call it worth the $10 a month. But The Good Fight, which is a Good Wife spinoff on CBS All Access, starring Christine Baranski, is the most fun show on TV right now. If you want some of the camp sensibility that you didn't get from this season of American Crime Story, the title sequence of The Good Fight is all like exploding handbags and high-heeled shoes and law books. Like, it is absolutely, I freaking love it.
That sounds great. All right, Matt, thank you so much. This has been a great conversation. Would love to have you back. Maybe the next show that I really get into that I need to hear your thoughts on. Anything you want to leave us with before I let you go?
No, just read my columns so that I don't get fired.
Perfect. Go to pacemagazine.com/TV. And again, find Matt on Twitter @TheFilmGoer. He's also very funny and has a lot of good thoughts on Twitter. All right, Matt Brennan, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks, Dan.